Good afternoon. You're listening to The Emily Rooney Show. I'm Emily Rooney. Well, the much maligned probation department is getting more negative press these days as a Boston Globe Spotlight Team report focuses on what the Boston Foundation report discovered a while back, that the department is rife with patronage, jobs, and waste. Its budget soaring 163% in 10 years. Both Governor Deval Patrick and Republican gubernatorial candidate Charlie Baker have asked for the attorney general to investigate the report and results of it. Independent candidate Tim Cahill is sort of taking the not-so-fast approach, maybe largely because he employs two of Jack O'Brien's relatives at the Treasury Department. And Jack O'Brien, of course, is the head of the probation department. It's all a tangled web. Here joining me in the studio to sort some of this out is Leonard Engel, who's a senior policy analyst at the Crime and Justice Institute in Boston. And he authored the Boston Foundation report that essentially blew the lid off this story a while back. Also here with me in the studio is John Larrabee, the CEO of Community Resources for Justice, which is the parent company of the Crime and Justice Institute. Well, Leonard, start with you. I mean, I went back and looked at your statistics. This was all here. The Globe put it all in perspective and kind of traced, I think, the most startling thing, but it was how many patronage jobs there are, how many, you know, friends and relatives of the well-connected work there, and the fact that these same people then turn around and give to the campaigns of people that have essentially put them on the, you know, from Sal DeMacy to the Bulger brothers. I mean, everybody's connected here. Why the probation department of all places?
That's a good question. The focus of our report with the Boston Foundation was on budgets and correctional outcomes, and we looked at all of the corrections agencies, and the probation numbers stuck out, rather largely. What we found is as we dug into it is more. More concerning to us is the lack of transparency, the lack of information. We had heard discussions and allegations and about patronage, but that wasn't the focus of the report. The focus of the report was primarily on correctional outcomes. The glaring thing with probation is the lack of data, the lack of information. We couldn't justify these massive increases in probation.
163% increase in 10 years?
Yeah.
The thing that the Boston Globe Spotlight, I mean, it was a great report, but one of the things, John, that it doesn't say is, well, what do all these people do for the probation department? How many people are on probation, for heaven's sakes? Do you know?
And that's some of the numbers that we're trying to get a better handle on is the caseload and what happens to the people on the caseload, what is being done on a day-to-day basis, and what are the outcomes we're getting. As Len was saying, that the deafening silence about for that kind of infusion of taxpayer dollars, what are the results from people on probation? We were able to get results from corrections, parole, county corrections. You take a look at some of the good stuff that's being done by police departments, our own Boston Police Department, using an evidence-based approach to how it deploys resources, and then reporting on the results, and they're good results. Not able to get that kind of information out about what is going on within the organization, what are the results coming from the organization. And it's something that we see as we look, not only within Massachusetts, there are evidence of well-run organizations producing good results in criminal justice and corrections, but across the country. It's accepted now, if you're a police agency, you do community-based policing, mm-hmm. and you use data and statistics to inform where you're going to be focusing your resources. It's true as well in probation and parole agencies across the country, and we weren't able to find that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I don't understand here, Leonard, is that the governor wants to put this whole department under public safety. Why isn't it there now? I mean, what expertise do any of these people have in criminal justice? I mean, zero. Wouldn't that be about right?
Well, I mean, the courts are part of the criminal justice system. So it's not a stretch to say that the courts, the trial court, should have some understanding and some involvement in probation. But what we've found across in our work in other states is that probation agencies, for the most part, are part of corrections and therefore part of usually combined with parole and under the executive branch. In Massachusetts, they're fairly isolated in the trial courts, and even as we found out in our report, And as was reported yesterday, they're even further isolated because of the work of the legislature in taking any control, any oversight away from the trial courts to manage it.
Why? I'm getting back to my original question. Why the probation department? Why not Health and Human Services? Why not? I mean, why did all these patronage jobs end up here, John?
As we looked around at sort of what makes an organization work, and I'm getting to that, is that there's a transparency about the organization, that they embrace these evidence-based practices about how we're going to be doing good probation. And we weren't able to learn that information from probation. I think part of the reason is there is not a clear commitment. We don't see a clear commitment to not only using the right tools, but achieving the right outcomes. So the attention wasn't on advancing the probation service in Massachusetts for the sake of public safety and producing good probation results. Mm-hmm. It was elsewhere.
Yeah. All right. I'm talking to John Larrabee from the Community Resources for Justice and Leonard Engel, also from the Crime and Justice Institute in Boston. Joining me here in the studio is Adam Reilly, who just got back from a press conference with Tim Cahill. Tim Cahill is somewhat on the defensive here. He's the independent candidate for governor because he has hired two of Jack O'Brien's relatives to work. This is a tangled web, I know, that work for in the Treasury Department. And he's saying, well, you know, not so fast. These people went through the proper channels and they went through the application process, unlike all these patronage jobs over at the probation department where people were just given flat-out favoritism if they were a relative of somebody in an important position in the state. So what did Tim Cahill say today?
Well, at his presser, he said that John O'Brien's wife, who works in customer service in the lottery, and John O'Brien's daughter, one of his daughters, who works in customer service in abandoned property, were qualified applicants who went through the usual channels, as you said a moment ago. He also really stressed that he and O'Brien, he said, you know, yes, we are friends. We got to know each other when our daughters played sports together. But we never talk about work when we socialize, which is, you know, for two high-ranking civil servants, maybe hard to imagine, but that's what he said. He said, I have never made a call to probation to try to get them to do something for me. He said that O'Brien's relatives, you know, wife and daughter, got their jobs without any intervention.
How can you say that with a straight face?
He did. He did.
I mean, you know, you think you'd go out of your way not to hire the friends and relatives of people so it even has an appearance of a conflict.
He would, but obviously, I mean, it's in a perfect world, that's, I think, what politicians would do. But as we've seen from this Globe series, I mean, the extent to which people go in the other direction is pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
Cahill, in addition, said, and this was interesting, he said that the probation department, once it was removed from control of the judiciary, became a monster. That was the word he used, a monster. And he said that the solution is to put probation back under complete judiciary control. He was attempting at today's presser to blame the legislature. He also said,
which the governor did also.
And he also said, this is a fair point, that if probation were put under gubernatorial control, for example, that there would probably be patronage hires involving people that the governor or associates of the governor knew, that patronage happens at every level of state government in many departments. Whether it's as acute in other departments as in probation is an open question. But he was saying, you know, this kind of stuff happens everywhere.
Okay. Joining me on the phone now is Republican gubernatorial candidate Charlie Baker. Charlie, who are you blaming for this mess?
I'm not blaming anybody in particular for this mess. But what I am saying, Emily and Adam, is I think we should do something about it. And my running mate, Richard Desai, last week fortuitously filed legislation to move the probation department back into the trial court as part of the budget discussion. That comes up on Wednesday, and the Senate will have a big opportunity here to take a big step in the right direction by doing that, thereby remedying what I think everybody agrees is one of the big issues here, which is these folks are operating completely outside the normal checks and balances that are supposed to exist in government.
I mean, does anybody have any idea at this point what all these people do? I mean, at this point, you know, the Globe has done a great job sort of looking at who's connected and who they've hired. But as the people here joining me here have, you know, the original Boston Foundation report found that, you know, that this thing has grown by 163% over 10 years. What do all these people do?
Well, the interesting thing about it, too, is it's grown by it's grown dramatically at the same time that the number of people actually under its supervision has fallen by 10%.
Right.
And this just gets back to the whole fact that we obviously have a big issue here from an accountability and a transparency point of view. Let's put it back under the trial court. Let's have the Attorney General go do an investigation around some of the cash management practices, which people should remember at a point in time when everybody's screaming about fiscal discipline and the state's fiscal situation and all the rest is a really big deal. The probation department handles millions of dollars, and also have them do an investigation on some of this hiring stuff. I mean, all I could think when I was reading that story is how frustrating and disappointing it would be for me if I was somebody who, you know, played by the rules, did everything I was supposed to do, worked my way up through the ladder, and then came to the conclusion that I was never really going to get to where I wanted to go unless I was willing to participate in political contributions. I mean, that's just a terrible message to send to people who are trying to do the right thing.
It's not good. Well, what do you think of Governor Patrick's attempt to reform probation? And also, he's blaming the legislature. He's saying that he tried to put this back under public safety, but the legislature wouldn't move.
Yeah, people have had issues with probation for a while. I mean, if you go back in just LexisNexis, that there are lots of stories that go back several years here. And this year was the first time the governor made a proposal on it. And frankly, I think the right proposal here is not to make it part of the executive branch. The right proposal here is to put it back in the trial court where it was in the first place. People thought Massachusetts had a pretty good probation department when it was part of the trial court, and it would seem to me that the easiest way to solve this problem, not create yet another problem from a conflict of interest or a public perception point of view, would have put it back with the trial court.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I sort of had
And by the way, Emily, we have a chance to do that. There's going to be an amendment offered during the budget debate. It's going to be offered by Richard Tse. People have an opportunity to vote up or down on it. I think everybody ought to concentrate on that. There's our first opportunity to really start cleaning this up.
I started wondering whether the whole thing was necessary. I mean, probation is such a farce anyway. John Laramie.
One of the things you would get if you put it back in the trial court is you could start to get serious about transparency with regard to measuring and monitoring performance with regard to people who are supposed to be under its supervision and what's going on there. Because some of the stories that broke in 2006 and 2007 literally had to do with very serious cases, one of which I think somebody was murdered who was in another state by a probationer who we never notified, our state never notified, the other state was no longer in Massachusetts.
John Larrabee, yeah. You want to come into the conversation?
Yes. A couple of advantages that we saw to the proposal of moving it into the executive is that one is some efficiencies. We've got offender supervision and incarceration going on in the executive branch under the public safety with corrections and county corrections and parole. Secondly is the efficiencies that we can get in supervising people in the community. So if we put our criminal justice corrections resources and attention and have the offenders sort of looked at in one pool, not just who's being supervised by probation in the trial court and who's being supervised by parole in the executive. All the research that we have on this says that we get the best results when we focus our resources on the higher risk people. And if you look at just the probation population, there are some people who score higher than others, obviously. Mm-hmm. If you fold in the other populations of inmates and parolees, you get a full spectrum, and we'll see that our higher-risk people are really not on probation. So we start to shift some of the resources we're spending on relatively low-risk probationers onto higher-risk offenders in prison and
Charlie,
in
you
parole.
Want to respond to that?
Well, I would just say that that's the kind of thing you could do, whether it was part of public safety or not. And I've thought all along that parole is a very different game than probation is for exactly the reason John just pointed out. And given the issue we now have, which is big concerns about who's being hired and why they're being hired and all the rest, I think the best thing to do would be to put it back the way it was. Because let's face it, no one thought Massachusetts' probation system was broken when it operated inside the trial court.
The other thing is that was about 15 years ago, as I read the history, and a lot a lot of advancement has been made in the world of probation, parole, community supervision. The research that has come out in the last 15 years is mountains compared to what we had back then.
Mm. Totally agree. But the easiest thing to do here would be to put it back where it was, and I'm hoping the Senate moves to do something on that this week, because let's face it, the way it's structured now clearly isn't working.
Yeah, I'd say that's correct. And this has definitely struck an outrage chord. All right, Charlie Baker, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, guys, take care.
Okay.
Bye.
All right, joining me here in the studio still is Leonard Engel from the Crime and Justice Institute in Boston and John Larrabee, who's CEO of Community Resources for Justice. What do you think is going to happen, Israel? We'll start with you, Leonard. Is Is the legislature not going to move on this? I mean, they've had decades to move on it, but now just because the Boston Spotlight report sort of rehashes, I'll give you guys all due credit here. I mean, your original report was their jumping off point.
Yeah, I credit the Boston Foundation for really, you know, seeing this as an opportunity to open up another area where good government could shine through. But I think hard to know what's going to happen. I think the opportunity here is to now bring forth the important public safety aspects of probation and to look at how probation should function in the system we have. We've seen now that probation hasn't functioned in the system, mm-hmm. the current criminal justice system. How can we make it more of a partner in the with the other criminal justice agencies, parole, corrections, and the sheriffs? The House is pretty far along. They've got their budget, so it's not going to happen in the budget. They've got some opportunities before the end of the session. They could still pass the governor's bill. I think the Senate is a real opportunity now that the budget is coming forward this week to take some action and move on some amendments.
You both have struck on something. I bet most people don't know, because I couldn't really define it, the difference between parole and probation. I mean, you know, I've seen enough movies. You're on probation. You check in every now and then, and have you been drinking? What does anybody do on parole? How does it even work?
Well, parole is a discretionary release for people who are incarcerated. So somebody gets a sentence of 5 to 7 years, parole. Mm-hmm. So somebody gets a sentence of 5 to 7 years, they're eligible for parole at a certain point, and after serving some time, they then get either, voted to parole, and they get a grant of parole and parole officers.
And they check in with the probation department.
No, we have a separate, completely separate infrastructure. Right. So we have a different administration of parole and parole officers who manage offenders who have been mm-hmm. incarcerated. We then have probation, which largely supervises offenders who are given community supervision in lieu of a prison sentence or a jail sentence. So they're lower level offenders largely. Some mm-hmm. Sometimes we have a lot of repeat offenders, but they're lower level offenders. They're
DUI, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, anything. And you've got a lot of nonviolent offenders, and they are they make up the bulk of the. Of the offender population in the state, most people who have been convicted of crimes are on probation rather than the other two options.
And it's like, what's the point, though? I'm serious about it. I mean, what's the point of it?
Well, ostensibly, it's to supervise two things: to supervise people in the community to watch them, but also to connect them to mm-hmm. services and programs to manage them. It's called a case management approach, to manage them through the remainder of their period and to basically give them the transitional opportunities so that they become stable taxpaying citizens. That's the goal. We don't know what probation has done in the state because we can't get any data from them.
All right.
Yeah, you were asking about what will happen. I think what will happen is, I know that the Boston Foundation and Community Resources for Justice agree that we need to continue to look at probation and the results in corrections generally and continue to push ahead on that. In terms of the changes, concern about the rush to do something and sort of missing the opportunity to do the right thing on this change, whether it's move it into the executive or keep it in the trial court, I think is just touching the possibilities. Mm. So if it stays in the trial court, how organized, how delivered, how is it, what are the accountability measures that are in place for outcomes? The same questions would be asked if it's in the executive branch. Mm. So the concern would be, are we just going to quickly rush something through in order to say that we've solved the problem of probation, which I think runs much deeper?
All right. John Larrabee, Leonard Engel, and here in the studio, Adam Riley. And on the telephone, we didn't get to Michael Keating. Thank you for your patience. I had one thing going after another here, and I'm sorry I didn't get to bring you into the conversation. Thank you all for being with us today. We're going to take a short break. When we return, what are you hearing about Downtown Crossing? You're listening to The Emily Rooney Show.
Support for WGBH comes from you. And from Somerset Subaru, recipient of the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety Award for all 2010 models. Somerset Subaru, here for you, here for life. Route 195 or SomersetAutoGroup.com. And from Proven Winners, are you ready to garden this spring? A wide range of Proven Winners plants and flowers to help beautify your home are available at centers like Hyannis Country Garden. More info at ProvenWinners.com.
Hi, I'm Ray Brown from WGBH's 99.5 All Classical Station. If you look forward to interviews with classical musicians on All Things Considered, or go back and forth between the news on 89.7 and the music on 99.5, then I hope to see you on June 19th for the first annual 99.5 All Classical Festival. Dozens of live performances, plenty of food and drink, and it all happens right here at the WGBH studios. Learn more and purchase tickets online at WGBH.org.
This is 89.7
WGBH,
Boston's NPR station
for trusted voices
and local conversation
with the world,
the PBS NewsHour,
and the Callie Crossley Show.
Explore new voices with us all day long
here on the new 89.7
WGBH.
I'm Callie Crossley. Tune in for a wide-ranging conversation. That's today at 1 after the Emily Rooney Show, only here on the new 89.7 WGBH, Boston's NPR station for news and culture.
You're listening to the Emily Rooney Show. Landlords, business owners, and residents of the downtown crossing area are sick and tired of waiting around for that elusive someone to do something about the now blighted area. While renovation at the Opera House and Paramount Theaters have spruced up the area a bit, the demise of Filene's, along with a general rundown appearance in the area, is attracting the wrong crowd. Bands of roaming teenagers, for one. Now a band of local businessmen are teaming together to form a downtown crossing partnership, raising money to pay for security and cleaning up the area. Joining me here in the studio is Ron Druker, president of the Druker Company, who serves on the board of the Downtown Crossing Partnership, and John Radigan, who's a partner at DLA Piper and the chair of the Downtown Crossing Partnership. Ron, welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Ron, a lot of other cities across the country do this. It's taken this city a while to get on board with this. I mean, finally, right?
Well, you know, there are 1,000 of them across the country, Emily, and it has taken a while in Boston, but we really banded together a group of property owners, retailers, both small and large, and residents to attempt to put together a business improvement district which will improve the environment in the downtown crossing.
And how does it work? Do you tap into all the businesses? Are you asking them for money? How does it work?
Well, there are criteria, and I can let John speak to that, but there are criteria where we need to achieve a certain percentage, in excess of 50% of the assessed values, and the same percentage in terms of the percentage of property ownership. Once that has happened, the vehicle becomes really an additional tax, and it's really self-taxing on our part, where approximately 15 cents to 25 cents will be added to our tax bill, which will be devoted to the maintenance, the security, and promotion of the area.
Well, John, is everybody on board with this? I mean, because it seems like you've already got a blighted area, and to add an extra tax onto all these businesses, are they hoping it's just going to pay off in the turnaround, or what?
That's exactly right. This is something that property owners across the country have used the business improvement district as a technique. It's just a technique to self-assess, to create a group that will collect money from all of the owners in the district and spend the money in the district. It's not somebody else. It's not the city. It's not the state. It's the owners themselves self-assessing to improve the district.
And what exactly are you doing? Give me a concrete example of what you're doing.
Exactly. The bid will do several things. Number one, clean. A city keeps this area as clean as a city can keep it. But private owners can keep it faneuil cleaner. When you go to Faneuil Hall, it feels different than when you're in an urban street. That's because it's a managed environment. This is the idea of a business improvement district, is to bring that kind of level of cleanliness to urban streets and make them feel like a managed environment and change the place. Similarly, there will be ambassadors on the street, which are not security guards. They're ambassadors. They're people that walk through the district helping tourists find their way around, walking into crowds.
Do tourists even go there anymore?
Oh, sure. One of the good things about downtown Boston is that there's a tremendous number of people there. You have the office district right next to the retail district. The retail district is in transition. It's changing. It's not – people don't shop as much downtown as they used to. But there's still vibrant retail there. People coming to and from work. There's an enormous number of people downtown.
I know. I was actually doing a piece on truancy. I guess it was about a year ago. I don't know. It was cold. It was when I've been in the fall. And I was shocked, Ron, to see how many kids were just hanging around down there, nobody doing anything worthwhile. You know, they were all, I'm applying for a job. They were just playing hooky is what they were doing. And then really walking around in there, it was depressing and it was sad. And some of it is the whole Filene's thing. I mean, is there any movement at all on the Filene's toll?
There are rumors, Emily, that the developers, who are very sophisticated people who got caught in a very tough economic climate, there are rumors that they're working on a new program that will allow it to move forward. But I think what's really important to recognize is that the Filene's project ultimately will happen. And that's one aspect of it. On the other hand, the combination of the Business Improvement District and a new Filene's will really be terrific. Mm-hmm. Because the fact is that when you look at H&M and Marshall's and Bath & Body and Champs and the other retailers who were down there, there are some major national retailers who were there who were still doing well. So in spite of the current conditions, there's volume to be done there, especially because of the symbiotic relationship with the financial district.
I'm talking to Ron Druker and John Rattigan, who are both part of the Business Improvement District program for the Downtown Crossing area. Well, is this group, John, going to put the Filene's developers? And I know, Ron, that we've had John Hines on the show. You know, are they going to put their feet to the fire about it? I mean, I know he's well intentioned, but enough already.
Well, this is a as Ron said, very sophisticated developers who started a project and ran into the teeth of the worst global economic recession of our lives. So it's pretty hard to be critical of them for not doing anything yet. But we're going to keep their feet to the fire in terms of going forward. I mean, this is it, as Ron said, it will be developed. They are working on plans. They are trying to figure out how to do it. But, you know, wishing and wanting and hoping and neighbors don't make a real estate development go. Mm-hmm. Financing and economics and tenants and the economic environment of what make a real estate project go. This business improvement district will facilitate the redevelopment of Filene's. It will be a signal to people who want to invest money in that location, whether those investors are from China or from Europe or from Federal Street in Boston. This Business Improvement District will send a signal that the property owners care about the neighborhood.
And really enhance the environment, making it more possible for the Filene's project to move ahead.
Ron, I'm curious about whether you've gotten the MBTA involved in this. The Park Street Station is kind of the gateway to the Downtown Crossing area, but that corner of the Common right over there where everybody egress is horrible. It's a dump. Are they involved? Of course, I think everything that the MBTA does is a disaster. You look at the Back Bay. It's disgraceful is what it is. Disgraceful that project, you know, downtown has been 4 years in the making and it's going to be another year before it's done. Are they on board at all with this?
Well, we go up to the corner of Winter Street and Tremont. We don't go to the other side.
You don't count that.
We don't.
Even though it's part of the...
No, it
that's
is.
Where all those kids are coming
that's
in from.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Well, why not? Come on, John. Get MBTA into the bid.
The MBTA is working with us, but they're more focused on the downtown crossing Station mm-hmm. and the State Street Station and the Essex Street Station, which are in our district. The problem with property lines or district lines is that you have to stop someplace. We have to have a big enough district so that we can actually make a difference and people will know we make a difference, but a small enough district so you can actually manage it. And so you have to draw lines, and our line goes down the middle of Tremont Street, mm-hmm. and maybe that's logical, maybe it isn't.
You know, you make a good point. I was walking through the financial district over the weekend and over to the north end, but I went through the whole Faneuil. I hadn't been to Faneuil Hall. I bet it's been 10 years, or since the last time I went to a debate in Faneuil Hall, but then you're just strictly, you know, destination-driven and just going right into the Faneuil Hall itself. But I was walking around there, and just – teeming with people. I mean, millions of people spilling all over. And you're right. It looked pretty darn good. Unlike other little neighborhoods. You forget how many neighborhoods there are in Boston. Even the Back Bay. Mayor gets mad at me for saying this. It's dirty. It's a dump. You know, everybody throws stuff on the ground. It's awful.
Well, one thing leads to another. And this goes back to the window broken windows theory.
Yes, yes.
Where people, if you can demonstrate that you care about an area, if the property owners and the businesses demonstrate that you care. Mm. People will be reluctant to throw their trash on the ground. If the trash container looks nice and it's empty and it's clean and it looks like the other trash containers and it looks like someone cares about the neighborhood, people will care more about the neighborhood. So this is about leveraging that sort of human impulse to treat a well-maintained neighborhood better.
I think people play up to their environment.
Well, you know, Ron, on that point, both the Opera House and the Paramount Theaters, I mean, these are huge renovations that are, I mean, millions of dollars in each of those and gorgeous and fantastic. And they're bringing a revitalized theater district, you know, to life down there. You'd think that they would have a spillover effect.
Well, they will. And they do. And they're attracting a lot of different people back to the downtown crossing. And I think what you'll see is that once the business improvement district is implemented, then you'll see something on a Saturday night, as I did last Saturday night on my way to the garden.
I was walking through that mess, too.
Through Faneuil
that
Hall.
What was that helicopter buzzing overhead all night? Did you
but
see
through
that?
Through Faneuil Hall.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was terrific. Yeah. I mean, the guy I was walking with and I commented on how terrific it felt.
Yeah.
And that's really what our goal is in the downtown crossing, to be able to turn that area into a place that becomes a destination on the weekends as well as 9 to 5 on Monday to Friday.
Talking to Ron Druker and John Rannigan about the downtown crossing area and the business improvement district. When will we start seeing a difference, John? I mean, you're collecting the money now. How much do you need? And ongoing does it have to be?
The process goes like this. And it's a state statute that permits people to create business improvement districts. Over the next month and a half, we'll be finishing our signature drive and we'll be collecting our signatures. That is the signatures from property owners in the neighborhood. During the summer, the city council will take up our petition and we're confident we'll create Boston's first business improvement district. The business improvement district will actually get created in the fall and will be in business by the holiday season. We won't actually get money until the beginning of 2011, but we'll raise private money to try and get something going for the holiday season.
You know what? I think you need a jazzier name.
The business improvement district, we'll try to come up with a jazzier name.
Yeah, come up with a jazzier name and then you might get other people to pitch in as well.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Pass the bucket.
That's a good idea. We've got some ad agencies and
people
downtown.
Yeah, get one of them
downtown
on board coming up with a slogan. You need a slogan.
They're helping us. They've come up with some slogans. We'll be introducing those as we get into business around the holiday season.
All right, so I'm not the first one to think of this.
No.
Okay. Ron Druker, John Rannigan, thanks so much for coming in. Good luck with this. It's a great idea. Business improvement. Actually, we'll take some bids out there. You guys got any good ideas we need a slogan or a better name for the business improvement district to spruce up downtown crossing?
I mean, they're looking for a nickname for Rajon Rondo, so perhaps we can find have a contest for the name of the business improvement district.
All right, you can email us at emilyrooneyshow@wgbh.org or on the web at wgbh.org/emilyrooney, and you can link to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thanks so much for coming in.
Nice to be here.
We're going to take a short break. When we return, the 25th anniversary of Sam Adams, the beer that is. Owner Jim Koch joins us. You're listening to The Emily Rooney Show. Stay with us.
Support for WGBH comes from you and from Sammet's Blackstone Associates, brand strategy, design, and digital media. 30 years of helping mission-driven organizations navigate change. You can visit them at sametz.com. And from New England Nurseries, a family business providing gardening enthusiasts with a wide selection of landscape supplies and services for over 100 years. Route 62 West in Bedford. Online at newenglandnurseries.com.
I'm Callie Crossley. From the bus stop to the boardroom, we'll bring you a wide-ranging conversation that taps into the talk of your town. We want to hear from you, too, so call in and become a part of the daily discussion. That's today at 1, right after the Emily Rooney Show, only here on the new 89.7 WGBH, Boston's NPR station for news and culture.
Thanks to a growing number of WGBH sustainers, the new 89.7 is Boston's NPR station for more news and less fundraising. With monthly installments as low as $5 and an automatic renewal service, WGBH sustaining membership is the easiest way to keep 89.7 stocked with more of the programs you want and less of the fundraisers you could do without. Become a sustainer. It's easy to do online at WGBH.org.
This is 89.7
WGBH, Boston's NPR station.
For trusted voices and local conversation.
With fresh air.
And the Callie Crossley Show.
The new 89.7 WGBH.
Doesn't have to do. You're listening to the Emily Rooney Show. Boston Beer Company, maker of Sam Adams, is celebrating its 25th year in business. They began selling Sam Adams Boston Lager on Patriots Day in 1985. Owner Jim Koch first brewed the beer in his own kitchen and delivered it in his own station wagon. Today, Boston Beer is the largest independently owned U.S. beer maker. And Jim Koch joins me, along with lots of beer here in the studio. And we have an official taster that we've brought along with us, Greater Boston's and WGBH's Jim Jeff Keating is here. He's already licking his chops. We've got glasses here. What'd you bring in here?
Anyway. Well, I brought you beer.
All right.
It's
I have some of that in my refrigerator. It looks familiar.
Good. You probably have Sam Adams Boston Lager.
That's what I have.
The original beer that I first made 25 years ago. And then we have Sam Adams Summer Ale because we do a seasonal rotation of beers. And then I brought you something new, which is from the Barrel Room collection of beers.
What do you call it, the 40-ounce?
Well, we don't call it a 40-ounce. This is actually a 750 ml. It is the size of a bottle of good wine or champagne.
And it's a gorgeous bottle.
Well, thank you. It comes from a barrel room at our brewery here in Boston where we're aging various beers in wood and trying out different fermentation techniques and different microorganisms in the beer.
When you started this, seriously, you were sort of a craft brewery. Did you think it was going to be a
Emily, when
a
I
success?
Started this, we were nothing.
You were nothing.
The whole company was two people.
But why did you – what? I mean, who – you know, we had Miller and Bud. I mean, what were you thinking?
Well, I rest my case. I mean, that was very simply – that was the idea is when I started Sam Adams, if you were an American beer drinker, you could not get fresh beer.
Yeah.
You could get the mass-produced beers, which, you know, they're fine for what they are. They do a great job of, you know, mass-producing enormous quantities of beer that is very consistent for what it is. It's well-made. It, you know, hits the spec. You'll never be disappointed. It's kind of the McDonald's and Taco Bell of beer. You could get that. Or if you wanted good beer, you had to turn to an import. And the imports are typically, you know, stale because it takes a long time to get them here. And they're often in green and clear bottles, which turn beer skunky.
Really?
So
yeah, I hate that.
It's a terrible taste.
What is the shelf life of beer? Like, what's yours?
It's a very good question. It's basically, for 99% of beer, it's about 4 or 5 months.
Whoa.
So
I got to get rid of some of that beer in my refrigerator.
Yeah, drink it.
Yeah.
Before it goes bad. Yeah. And it's not like
you
know,
if you keep it refrigerated, it still goes
yeah,
bad.
It's yeah. probably if it's been in your refrigerator, you can probably get 6 or 7 months. If
oh,
it's
I been think in I've been in there a couple of years.
Yeah, yeah. And you got to remember, it sat in a warehouse before that at a distributor, and then it was at a liquor store. So when you get it, it might be 2 months old.
But a beer like yours is. I mean, it's fresh, so it's going to go – you got to drink it even quicker.
Yeah, no, it's about the same.
Same as everybody.
And we make it very simple. We're the first American brewer to put consumer-friendly freshness dating on the beer. Every bottle of Sam Adams on the left side of the label says, for brewery fresh taste, enjoy before month notched. And this
really?
Beer
is notched
in
say?
September.
Really?
So
all right, let's
until
have
September.
A taste of some of this. Jeff, you ready?
I'm here. I'm ready.
Can I see your ID? Ooh, listen to that.
These are just sound effects. We're not
really
drinking beer on the air. God forbid
God, that looks gorgeous.
We do something like that. Well,
Now, what's with the glass?
This is a specially designed glass. You know, everybody knows that good wine is better enjoyed in the proper glass. I mean, you're not going to drink a really good wine out of a juice glass or a pint glass or a Dixie cup because the shape and the size and the configuration of the glass actually changes your perception of the wine. And the same thing is true with beer. So
okay.
I spent a year working with three PhDs in sensory science to develop
we should describe
the proper
it.
Beer
it's
glass.
It's quite narrow at the bottom, then it comes wide in the middle, and then it narrows a little bit more at the top.
Yeah, and
so
those are functional. This is a sort of a Bauhaus glass.
Yes.
Its form follows function.
It's like a pint glass, like pinched in the middle almost.
Yeah, it's sort of an hourglass, each kind of shape, and it turns outward at the lip because that puts the beer on the front of your palate, because with a good beer like Sam Adams, you want to taste the malty sweetness of the beer first. You want a certain sort of procession of flavors across your palate that's basically body and sweetness of the malt followed by the spiciness and bitterness from the hops. Hmm. That's the basic
that
structure
has a beautiful
of beer's
head
flavor.
On it too.
Well, a good beer will have a really nice head, because you know what the head on the beer is made out of? You know what that is? It's protein.
Mm.
Looks like meringue.
Oh, well, in that case.
It's aerated protein.
Oh, go ahead.
You know, and a really good beer, an all malt beer with really first-class ingredients, will have a head so thick that you can actually float the bottle
He's
cap.
He's floating the bottle
there
cap
it
right
is.
On the top of the
Just
head.
Just a happy little boat there on the top of the beer. And that's from the protein that came with the malt. And then when you pour it, you aerate that protein and you make all these protein bubbles that are very firm and are strong enough to actually float the head on it.
Now, I have to admit, when I have a Sam Adams from time to time, I drink it right out of the bottle.
Me too. I was about to say, there's
well,
something about it.
Would you drink a great wine out of the
bottle?
No,
but I'll tell you why I do. I feel like it keeps its bubbly longer if it's in the bottle.
Probably doesn't, because you keep sloshing it back and forth.
Well, I have my wine out of a Dixie cup, and
well, there you go. Then, but that's how you're doing it,
There's a lot of foam on the top here.
Yeah.
Do you consume the foam? I mean, should you wait or?
You kind of let it settle. As you go to
that bottle cap is still floating there. I have to say that's impressive.
I'll try not to.
I'll take it off. But just like you do in Europe, when they pour the beer,
they got to go right for the foam though. The foam is great. No.
Yeah, and you taste through the foam. I mean, the foam ends up on your lip and gives you like a got milk mustache, and there's nothing the matter with that. And the foam is little bubbles of hop aromatics, so they actually release as you drink the beer. So
I'll try this one. This was the
Boston Lager.
Boston Lager.
And then I just poured a summer ale.
All right.
And you've got this really nice sort of crown of foam on
nice
the top of it.
I have to say, I didn't expect coming to work getting served
a cold beer
by Jim Coke.
Yeah,
it's pretty
cheers.
Impressive. Talking to Sam Adams, Jim Coke, who's celebrating his 25th year in the business, and my official taster here, who's got his got milk mustache, Jeff Keating.
Excellent.
How is that?
It's very good. It's excellent.
Taste it mindfully. Do you get body and sweetness from the malt, then spiciness and bitterness of the hops? And it's about – try it again and mindfully look for that. And you'll get it in about a 3-4 second sequence. body, sweetness, spiciness, bitterness.
It is very complex.
Yeah.
It's very good. I don't know if I'm picking up on everything, but I wouldn't consider my
Now, what's the
be
difference
the
between
refined.
The two? His is darker and yours is
well,
the summer.
Well, they're quite different. And you have to remember that quality beer like Sam Adams and other craft beers bring to the drinker more range and variety, for example, than you'd get with wine, because I have much more flexibility as a brewer with my ingredients than the poor winemaker does with their one solitary ingredient, grapes. So in the Boston Lager, it has two-row malt, a very classic recipe, and then what are called noble hops, these sort of heirloom hops of the lager brewing tradition that are only grown in Bavaria. Then you get to the summer ale. I mean, it's summer. We have real seasons here in New England. It starts to warm up. This is a lighter beer with we use some wheat malt, which is a little crisper. And then we don't fully filter it, so it has a haze, which is the protein from the malt in it. And in summer ale, I add lemon zest and this historic brewing spice has a wonderful name. It's called Grains of Paradise.
Ooh.
And so this has and it's an aromatic member of the pepper family. It used to people thought it was an aphrodisiac when it was discovered 500 years ago, and that's where the name came from.
So you clearly understood beer before you got into making it. I mean,
sure, my dad was a brewmaster.
Okay.
And my grandfather was a brewmaster, my great-grandfather and my great-great-grandfather.
So you knew how to brew beer. That was
I grew up around beer. I had come from a commercial brewing background. So I had, been in breweries. I think I made my first beer with my dad when I was like 6. So yes, I was very familiar with beer, but it was really from another earlier time before all this mass production. And that was kind of the miracle of Sam Adams, is it brought to the 20th century beer from really the golden age of American brewing in the second half of the 19th century.
I can remember explicitly when it first came in 1985. But how did you come up with the name Sam Adams?
I thought of lots of different names, and the beer came from my great great grandfather's brewery, and it was called Lewis Cook Lager. But my name is German, and
it's Cook. It's Cook.
Yeah,
right.
I know. Get it. Yeah. So I thought, let me put something that people can pronounce on there, and then I thought about, all right, I'm in Boston. Let's. And I thought about all these names, and I ended up settling on Samuel Adams because he was a very compelling historical figure. He was a revolutionary, and I wanted to create a revolution in beer. And he was a brewer. He had a brewery in downtown Boston.
Oh, he did.
Wow. Brewer, patriot, revolutionary, and people can pronounce it. That's great.
Now, where is it mostly brewed now?
I started here in Boston. We still have our original brewery in Jamaica Plain. It's on the Stony Brook station of the Orange Line. And then as we've expanded, I actually bought a brewery where I grew up and where my father had worked in Cincinnati. And then a couple of years ago, as we continue to expand, we bought an old brewery in Pennsylvania.
Do you import at all? Do you export, I should say? Can I go over to Germany and get a Sam Adams?
Yeah, you can, actually.
That's cool.
Sam Adams was the first American beer to ever pass Germany's beer purity law and be imported into Germany. So that was very cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
You could go Sam Adams is an imported beer, just not here in Germany.
Now, I need to ask you about this thing that Senator John Kerry is trying to do. You pay these taxes. They're onerous taxes on every barrel of beer.
Yeah.
He's trying to get those. I was surprised at how big they were.
Yeah, we pay like $40 million a year in taxes. But
Between $7 and $18 in excise tax for each barrel brewed.
Yes. And what I think Senator Kerry objected to and Congressman Neal, who originated this last year, is that I pay the same excise tax as, you know, Anheuser-Busch does. And you know, they are 150 times my size. And so there's really very little graduation in that tax. And they thought, gee, maybe instead of paying $18 a barrel, they'll pay $16 a barrel. So there's a small tax break to the smaller independent American brewers. And Senator Kerry and Neil are both very involved in helping small business.
Oh, I thought it was going to actually like cut it in half, but it wouldn't.
No, no. But it's at least, you know, a graduated tax. And that's okay.
Yeah, because everything else isn't graduated. Yeah. Well, has it gone through yet?
No. They're both still, Senator Kerry and Congressman Neal are both working on it. I think we have 8 co-sponsors in the Senate side and 70 on the House side. So, and there's just a lot of support around the country for small businesses like breweries, craft breweries that we're growing. We're creating jobs.
Well, talking to Jim Cook of Sam Adams, what do you got brewing for the next 25 years? You got something else?
Oh,
in
the
hopper, so to speak?
Oh, we're always working on
a bottle of something over
there.
See. We haven't tried that one yet.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-oh,
this
quickly.
This is called New World Triple.
That's got a cork. It's gorgeous.
It's finished like a champagne.
it looks like champagne.
Well, and it's much stronger. It's about 10% alcohol.
Really?
And it's a mixture of different fermentations. It's not
just the taster.
I'm not ordinary yeast. This has a whole set of different microorganisms that come out of the wood that we age the beer in. So this is going to be quite different than any normal beer. So much fruitier. It's got
excellent.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
There we go. That's all you need to say.
Yeah.
I won't tell you about all the microorganisms and the barrel aging.
Please don't.
And the
microoxidation. all the protein on the top.
Yeah. But it's all really comes down to today in the United States, as a result of this craft beer revolution that Sam Adams helped pioneer 25 years ago, today beer has become the new wine.
Hmm.
And 20-somethings are adopting beer, craft beer, in the same way that their boomer parents adopted wine. Because when I came of legal drinking age, I hate to say this, but it was 1967. And you know what the largest selling wine was in the United States in 1967? Because it was a whole different world for wine.
Gallo.
Well, that's a producer. They made it. Oh. The largest selling American wine was Thunderbird.
Thunderbird. Oh, my goodness.
And think of where we've come in the 40 years since Thunderbird was the number one wine. Well, beer is going down that same evolution and awakening. And
all
it's
right.
very exciting.
Jim Cook, congratulations on your 25th year with Sam Adams Beer. And thanks for leaving this
thanks
here for us.
Thanks for bringing your designated drinker.
Thank you, Jim.
All right, that's going to do it for us this afternoon. Tune in tonight to Channel 2 for Greater Boston. We're going to be talking to independent gubernatorial candidate Tim Cahill about the probation department mess, plus Up in Your Business with Chris Frieswick on how the Natick Collection Mall and condos are doing. That and more tonight at 7. The Emily Rooney Show is a production of 89.7 WGBH, Boston's NPR station for news and culture. On the web at wgbh.org/Emily Rooney. The Callie Crossley Show is coming up next. I'm Emily Rooney. Have a great afternoon.